from 90.5 WESA, this is The Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Kevin Gavin. A new school year is getting underway, but it's one that's required a different mindset and adjustments as the pandemic continues.
And the last call that I was on with the Department of Ed was, do what's best for your kids. So that tells every district, well, you're on your own and make it work.
And there isn't just one plan that fits all. Coming up, a conversation with three Pittsburgh area school superintendents. Plus, teachers will be greeting and teaching their students virtually, at least for several weeks. And because of the remote learning, some parents are turning to learning pods.
So by creating neighborhood learning pods, it provides an opportunity for children to have that sense of structure.
Learning as a group, but not in a classroom. A special edition of The Confluence starts now. Back to school. It's a phrase we hear every year at this time, but it has a whole new meaning this year, a time that has challenged administrators, teachers, parents, and of course, students. Should students literally go back to school, their classrooms, or are kitchens and living rooms becoming the new classrooms? How effective and equitable can remote learning be? We're going to discuss the challenges and opportunities that are presented with the leaders of three area school districts. Dr. Caroline Johns is the superintendent of Northgate School District. Welcome.
Good morning.
Mr. James Harris is the superintendent of the Woodland Hills School District. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Good morning.
And Dr. Anthony Hamlet is the superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Welcome, Dr. Hamlet.
Thank you. Good morning.
The governor ordered schools to close in mid-March. Give me one or two things that you learned from trying to continue that school year that maybe helped you prepare yourself for this new school year. Dr. Johns, we'll start with you.
Well, I learned that we can pivot quickly when we need to. So we moved from in-person to online learning within 2 weeks. And while it wasn't what we wanted it to be because it was so quick, we learned a lot from that experience about how we could do online learning moving into the fall and looking at this year, knowing that even if we are able to return in a hybrid model, we're still going to have disruption. So what we're realizing now is they really need some structure in their lives. And so we've redone our online program to add schedules, time online when they're in class, just as they would be if they were actually in-person learning.
Mr. Harris, what did you learn from the shutdown to help you prepare for this new school year?
One of the things we realized right away was that our students didn't have the technology or the devices or the capability at all to reach the internet, reach the online material. So we had a lot of infrastructure, devices and things that we had to get out to families and instruct the families on how to do these things. And we have a very seasoned group of teachers who are used to teaching face-to-face. Well, how do you transition that face-to-face instructional environment to now you're sitting in front of a Chromebook or an iPad? Mm-hmm. Also, with all the laws that are involved in special education, FERPA, making sure that the contacts are appropriate, and how we engage, and a lot of students have individualized educational plans. How do we meet those needs of those students remotely? So over the summer, we really didn't take a summer break. It was all planning. So from March 13th on, I think all the superintendents will agree, no one took a vacation because one, you couldn't go anywhere. Everything was shut down. And two, what do we do?
Dr. Hamlet, what did you learn from the shutdown to starting a new school year?
We were planning at some point in the next couple of years to go one-to-one. So this expedited that going one-to-one. And what happened in the spring was that all of our students did not have devices. And to James's point, we had to worry about FAPE. FAPE, free appropriate education for our special education students and those IEPs, and make sure they have the same rights and opportunities as regular ed students. We took about 3 weeks to actually get up online. So we had an online component if kids had devices, but we also purchased technology where if kids didn't have a computer, they can actually call into the environment where a teacher was teaching the class and interact with the teacher and other students as well. We actually had to print out thick instructional packets that we passed out at our grab-and-go sites. That's our few food distribution sites at our schools. One thing from the very beginning of when this happened, realizing that, and I'm sure that's true of this other school district as well, we have a high number of students, if not all of them, that rely on our food distribution, that breakfast and lunch that we get. So one of the things we wanted to do first was mobilize our distribution sites. We used our schools around the city to make sure that we had hours for families to come pick up food for their children. So right now, it'll be vastly different in the fall. Why? Because all of our students who need a device will have a device and internet access as well, and they can actually log on and interact in a synchronous environment.
What do you mean by one-on-one?
When we go one-to-one, that means every student in the district has a district-given device.
Aren't several thousand devices still on back order that you're waiting for? So do all of your students have the devices?
By the time school starts, all of our students that need a device should have a device. We may not be one-to-one, but every student that needs a device will have a device, a computer, and internet access.
So some of them will be personally owned, some of them will be from the district.
In context, I would say almost every district in the nation and also every business is trying to order computers right now. So it's a supply and demand issue right now. And so, and I'm going to tell you one story. We had ordered from this particular company back in the end of March. We kept asking for the computers. They're coming. Come to find out, the computers got stopped coming into America because the factory in China had human rights violations. So the whole 7,000 computers had to go back. So we had to scramble to find another group in the states that actually had devices in their stock. So we did that, and we were fine.
Will your online learning, instructing, will it be synchronous, as in, teachers in front of a classroom virtually, almost like a giant Zoom call, or what? Mr. Harris, let's start with you.
So yes, the teachers will be doing Zoom meetings where it's live, but those meetings will also be recorded. So our intent is to have the students, particularly high school, sign in at 7:20 in the morning, and they have their schedule, and they're going to follow through their schedule. Then they'll take their lunch break, and then they'll do their work, and those lessons will be recorded.
Will you keep track of who's attending the Zoom meetings, the classroom, virtual classrooms?
This year, when the students were picking up their schedules and speaking with the principals, they were shocked at how different this time is versus back in the spring. In the spring, we were all just trying to get by. And the work the state put out was really the grade shouldn't be lower than what the students had back in March, and it was all really extra credit. This time, all the districts, I'm sure, have learned what we need to do, and now we're going live. We have to take attendance. Everything counts. So my high school students, I tell them, and my daughter, who's a freshman this year, she's like, oh my gosh, I have to get up at dawn to get my hair done. We have to be dressed. You can't be in your pajamas. You can't be rolling in at any time. You have to be in front of that computer with your teacher. We're taking attendance. The work does count, and it matters. And particularly for the high school students, this is not a blow-off year. These grades count. They'll go in your final transcripts. They'll be transferred with you, whichever higher ed institution you go to. So this is real.
Dr. Johns, synchronous learning, teachers in a classroom, and all students in attendance virtually. How's it going to work?
In the middle school, high school, the students will follow the regular schedule. It's synchronous learning. We take attendance in homeroom, and then they are in their classrooms. Similar in elementary, we have chunks of time where the students will be online in live lessons. However, we are going to have some families that are going to need asynchronous learning. We have some of our high school students who have to work right now to support their family.
Dr. Hamlet, is it teaching a full classroom virtually? How's it going to work for PPS?
Yes, we'll be in live synchronous learning. The teachers will actually be teaching, and the students can interact and back and forth with the teacher and the student. So it'll be a live synchronous actual instruction going on. But one of the things we had to look at and look at the research around screen time, we know it's difficult for adults to sit in front of a computer for 5-6 hours a day, let alone students. So when we did our instructional framework, we were intentional about putting brain breaks frequently within the instructional schedule to make sure kids weren't getting burned out from being on the screen.
When the schools shut down and not all of your students could have access to electronic devices, et cetera. You used information packs. Some parents criticize that as just being reviewing information rather than teaching, moving ahead. Are you going to be using information packs at all during this new school year?
If a parent requests that, that may be a possibility, but we fully expect everybody to have a device based on need and also internet access so they can access the online and synchronous learning.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA, a special education program looking at the start of the new school year. Each of your districts is starting the school year virtually, as we've noted, with remote learning. What are you doing for special needs students who we're often told are more successful with in-person contact, in-person instruction? Dr. Johns, you have a background in teaching special needs kids. Let's start with you.
I have to give a shout out to our special ed teachers and our paraprofessionals who were exceptional in the spring and I think will be exceptional this fall. They have gone above and beyond reaching out to these students, working with them online. Our paraprofessionals essentially get online and work with our students as they're working through their assignments. Our special education teachers work with the regular ed teachers, modifying the lessons, and then maintaining close contact with both the students and their families to make
sure. In-person contact?
Not in person, online. Mm-hmm. Although we have students who do better with hands-on learning. So our teachers put bags together of educational activities, drop them off at their house, and then with the parents' permission, stood back from the door and had an opportunity to say hello to the students and have some personal interaction.
Mr. Harris, I believe your district is doing a case-by-case acceptance of for special needs students, whether there should be in-person instruction?
Yes, we've identified about 10% of our special ed students. We're bringing them back. They will be in the buildings getting the instruction they need because we felt, this is one of the big things that happened in the spring, that those students, we really couldn't educate appropriately. So we all sat down and agreed with our special ed directors and the teachers and the team that's involved. 10% of those students were identified as having the needs that cannot be met virtually. So we are bringing them back into the buildings. There's about 20 per building that will be face-to-face with students. I'm sorry, with teachers.
Traditionally, do any of your students receive medical care on-site as well? And if so, is that an issue this time around?
A lot of our students also get mental health care at schools. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we are struggling to deal with because of the services and supports that schools also offer.
Are you expecting an even greater impact? I mean, this pandemic has affected so many people in their mental health. And are you expecting that with your students?
Well, students and staff. You know, students, teachers are people too. And I know when we did our graduation, which was virtual, was the first time in, I think it was May or June, we had our graduation in June. I was around that many people at one time. And you are a little anxious when you see this many people around you when you've been staying in your house for 3 months. So having teachers come back, we're working with our staff to make sure that they feel comfortable too. You know, we kind of forget it's not just students in the building. We have hundreds of teachers that are putting their lives at risk in some cases or their families at risk to come back.
With the schools shut down for the last 2.5 months of the last academic year, and you are all beginning this year remotely, how can you be confident that your students are ready academically for this year and will be able to learn what they should this new academic year? Dr. Hammett, we'll start with you.
I would say definitely not confident in that they've learned the skills they need to learn last year because they have a significant learning loss. Number one, you already have a summer slide where our most marginal students begin to lose the education they learned over the course of the school year. But also coupled with the COVID slide as well, it's going to be some significant drops for our students. And so we know that. We're planning interventions to put in place as a result of that.
What do you need in terms of guidance, support from the state?
Relief from the state exams. So we are at right now going to have the usual Pennsylvania PSSAs
right
in the spring. And I think that is going to create a significant sense of anxiety. I mean, as you asked in your last question, we expect that students are going to have some learning loss, and we're going to be working hard to make that up. I don't know that this year there is going to be value in taking instructional time away for testing on material that students, because of the circumstances, may not quite be ready for.
Mm-hmm. Finally, the pandemic has obviously caused all sorts of challenges for you folks, for parents, for teachers, for staff, for the kids. But has it also given you an opportunity to think about how you want to educate children in the future?
There's actually a good part about this pandemic where it forced us to jump 2 or 3, 4, 5 years ahead of where we would be technology-wise. I mean, we're looking at going one-to-one where we were only just having conversations about that. But the need was always there. So this forced us to go out and seek the revenue, the funding, and to sort of reboot on how we instruct.
So is it an opportunity, Dr. Caroline John?
Our teachers are becoming more and more proficient with online resources that are going to allow them to personalize learning for students as we move forward.
So yeah, if you sit back and think about it, and I use this analogy a little bit, think about Little House on the Prairie in the one-room schoolhouse with desks and rows. Now, fast forward to now, what's different? You probably have some projectors. You probably have a dry erase board instead of a chalkboard. But what has truly changed? If you look at every other industry, they have actually evolved. And so now, to James's point, it's time for us to evolve into a different way of teaching our kids based on the current context.
Yeah, I heard the analogy as this is like building a plane as you're learning to fly it,
yes,
while you're flying
mm-hmm.
it. You know, so we're trying to build programs yeah. while we're moving along, and we're all learning how to do it at the same time.
Dr. Caroline Johns is the superintendent of Northgate School District. Mr. James Harris is the superintendent of the Woodland Hills School District. And Dr. Anthony Hamlet is superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Thanks so much to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you
for having us.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This fall, tens of millions of students across the country will return to school in some form. Some will learn online, some will learn in person, some are opting for pod schools. Linda Hippert is an assistant professor in Point Park University's School of Education. She's the former executive director of the Allegheny Intermediate Unit and prior to that, the superintendent of the South Fayette School District. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Linda, what is a pod school? How new is this concept?
Well, a pod school, although it has a different name, is probably nothing new, something we've been doing for years in different ways. So a pod school is really nothing more than a group of children being together and learning together. Primarily, as described right now, that is occurring in neighborhoods where families are gathering students who are usually in the same age range, and they're bringing them together to create some sense of normalcy of school.
So why might a parent want to place their child in a pod? Is it familiarity, some other reason?
So I think there's several reasons. You know, we realize that particularly young children, when they are coming to school, it allows that time for both parents to work outside the home. So one is, I think, to alleviate a period of time for the parents to do other things. Most importantly, I think that parents know that the structure of school is very important, as well as the socialization. So by creating neighborhood learning pods, it provides an opportunity for children to have that sense of structure and to be together and to socialize in a learning environment.
Conversely, what might be any disadvantages to the traditional learning environment?
Well, in most cases, it is not a structured curriculum that is being provided. Oftentimes it's tutoring. Now, I strongly recommend parents who are involved in this or communities that they really work with the school. And that's the best situation anyway, whether we're in traditional school or we're in this situation we are in right now, where the parents are partners with the teachers and with their school. So what can they do to enhance the learning that is taking place?
Critics have said pod schools will worsen educational disparity. The kids whose parents can put together a pod are the ones who will likely be fine regardless, but they could hurt kids who aren't in a pod and fall behind. Is there a way to make these learning arrangements equitable?
First of all, I would absolutely agree with that. Sometimes parents just don't have the means, and they have, whether it's other responsibilities or just the wherewithal to be able to seek out opportunities for their children. And I think we're very fortunate in the Pittsburgh region to have our foundations and the many after-school programs, community-based programs, our religious and our church programs, and every parent cares about their child and wants them to learn. But that doesn't mean they have to hire a tutor. You know, I'll even say at the university level, there are students who are preparing to be teachers. So they're not certified teachers yet, but they're well on their way. And they have to put in so many hours of field experiences. So they love children. That's why they're choosing to be educators. And they would be probably more than happy to engage in those experiences where they're helping a child in a community setting and tutoring them.
We talked a little bit about the social interaction and that the pods can sort of duplicate that experience of not being in the classroom of, or, you know, what the classroom is like, I should say. The harm of being kept out of school, whether it's academic, social, emotional, psychological, physical, they're felt by children. But could this disproportionately impact those with the least resources that they don't necessarily have the opportunity to interact with other children?
Oh, yes. And we know that socialization is important. It's a very important part of going to school. Certainly academics are the priority. But while you're learning, you're also learning how to get along with others. You're learning how to deal with people who may not be the same as you, who may not think the same. And that's an important gap that exists during this pandemic. So anything that can be done, like bringing children together to create some sense of normalcy and socialization, is extremely important.
Linda Hippert is an assistant professor in Point Park University's School of Education and the former executive director of the Allegheny Intermediate Unit. Linda, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh public school students were supposed to return to virtual learning this week. The district, though, delayed the start of the year for another week because many of the 23,000 students don't have computers. Thousands of the devices that the district purchased are backordered. But as 90.5 WESA's Sarah Schneider reports, that's just one of the hurdles that teachers anticipate this fall.
Melanie Williams says she doesn't know how she will do her job if students don't have computers or internet access.
Honestly, I don't know what we're going to do. I've called my parents, and I would say in my home room, which is 23 kids, maybe I think 4 or 5 of them have a laptop.
She teaches 7th grade math at Pittsburgh Classical Academy in Crafton Heights and expects that she won't be able to introduce new content for a couple of weeks. That's because even if students do have technology, she'll have to teach them how to use the new platforms.
Like, so for example, like even to get to, let's say, their online book, it's like 4 or 5 good steps.
Teachers spent most of the week before school learning how to use the platforms and set up their remote classrooms. They haven't, though, learned how to perfect the craft of virtual instruction. For young students, they'll likely need someone like an older sibling or a parent to help facilitate the process. And if it's too difficult, Williams worries that students will just give up.
So it's like practicing those steps, making sure that they don't check out. My biggest thing is like, stay with me. You know, we got this, we can do it. And don't check out. Because once they check out, it's hard to get them back.
The district decided to teach students remotely for the first 9 weeks of the year. The board made that call when COVID-19 cases were increasing in the region. It does have a detailed plan for when or if students return in person. All 10 of the teachers I spoke to for this story said while they desperately want to be in person with their students, they're glad the year will begin remotely. Jess Vishner teaches culinary arts at Westinghouse Academy in Homewood. His wife had COVID-19 in March and is still recovering with limited mobility. He's concerned about the health of his family, but he knows that students will suffer this year. I talked to him and two of his colleagues together on Zoom. They say the biggest loss will be relationship building.
One of the skills that we share is that we all connect really well with our students. And so much of that is by being there in person and sharing a space with them. There are so many side conversations that happen when we're in a classroom. You see the look on a student's face and you know something's just up. And I think that that's going to be tremendously difficult to do that aspect of our jobs, which is something that we all have gravitated to because that's how we make those academic gains, is by having those emotional gains with our students.
Teachers are also concerned about the quality of instruction they can provide. For decades, educators have preached that hands-on exercises tend to be the most engaging way to learn. But high school teachers might lose out on experiments or class discussions. Michelle Halloran teaches social studies at Alderdice High School.
I see myself as like a super discussion-based interactive teacher. And so not like I still taught a lot online last year. And, you know, initially I was probably getting 80 to 90% of my kids showing up, but then died off quite a bit. So that was really difficult.
Necessity is the mother of invention, though, and teachers are finding solutions. Edwina Kitchington, a science teacher at the Science and Technology Academy in Oakland, is packing supplies to send home lab kits.
I think we're all working really hard to try to make it rigorous, but doable for the students and the teachers.
But Monica Dugan, who teaches biology and astronomy at Westinghouse in Homewood, does not have access to those supplies.
Science is not something you do in a book. It's something you do in the world. And so, you know, when they don't have that hands-on experience, they're definitely losing part of their education. So I think my job at this point is to make as much of the content very real-world applicable.
Dugan and the other teachers I spoke to say they'll figure it out. They just need a little bit of patience and understanding from families. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We love questions here at WESA. We spend all day asking them. If you have a kiddo in your life, you know that kids love to ask questions too. These questions might come out of the blue and leave you saying, I just don't know. Well, let The Confluence help. Send us your kids' questions and we'll ask teachers across the state to answer them. To kick it off, here's a question we had. How long does it take to digest gum? So we asked Edwina Kitchington, a science teacher at Science and Technology Academy in Oakland.
So that's a good question. I don't know exactly, but if you swallow gum, I mean, eventually you will digest it because of the acid in your stomach. It will be digested, yes. It just may take longer because of the components.
We've got a group of teachers ready to help us out. Send your questions to confluence at WESA.fm. And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. If you enjoy what you're hearing, there's even more to read on our website at WESA.fm, where our newsroom is rounding up everything you need to know about how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting our region and beyond. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Julia Zenkovich, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.